The National Broadcasting Company presents Analog.
My name is Morris Rennick, and I'm the author of a book called Siam, Miami.
And my name is Ishmael Reed, and I'm the author of two novels, the first being The Freelance Pallbearers, and the second one, Yellowback Radio Broke Down.
I grew up what you would call then a slum area in Brooklyn, and then I became a reporter covering the black ghettos of Harlem and Brooklyn, mainly for the New Republic.
I grew up in Buffalo, New York, which is 500 miles upstate, but it could be like on the backside of Mars. And there I learned the possibilities of describing what some people call the silent majority, because this is like a mean mentality of the American mentality in Buffalo. And I describe this mentality in my work. And if that turns out to be satire and humor, well, this is what my work is about.
Having just read your book, Ishmael, The Freelance Pallbearers, I think you're a brilliant exponent of what I would call zap humor, sort of a swift punch, and you don't know where it's coming from. What got me into Siam, Miami was, not this kind of humor, but a more, what I would say, a pervasive kind of humor. You know, it has nothing to do with values, but which the way you look at the people. You don't have to report to know that there's something wrong with this country. There's a, they say America is a classless society, but the classlessness is that we're all uncomfortable, you know, whether we're high or low. But I think, you know, if you're really going to get into the guts of a reading experience, you know, you have to bring back the world for the reader in fiction, you know, because the reader usually doesn't have time, but, you know, a writer does, because that's his, you know, that's his main job.
You mean by
returning the world to them.
Returning the world.
To them,
the
yeah.
real world.
Yeah, right.
Well, see, I'm not really dealing, my work, I don't really deal with the real world. I mean, it's, I'm getting most of my letters on the pallbearers and Yellowback from science fiction writers. I think that for what I call the naturalist or the realistic novelist, I think that what we see in documentaries and what we see on, I think television has it covered. I mean, there's nothing that a novel can do that can surpass like the coverage of the Chicago Convention or the assassinations or, you know, some of the terrible events that have transpired in the 60s. There's a split among black writers as well as among white writers in this country, if I can speak generically, you know, over what should be the emphasis. Should it be on talking about how one is engaged in these times,
right, mm-hmm.
or writing autobiographies, mm-hmm. or doing reportage like Miami and the Siege of Chicago,
right.
or
yes.
on the other side you have like in your struggle, which I consider like, you know, a major one in this country, you get Burroughs, William Burroughs, mm-hmm. who's writing about like fantasy and science fiction, you know, like a Nova Express mob, this kind of thing. So I think you find the same split among black writers, whether, you know, you should be engaged or whether you should create what Andre Moreau calls a rival dream factory to Hollywood and to television and to the news.
I feel that the dream is in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
the nightmare is in the streets. And I say the journalists, being one myself, don't know the whole picture. And that's why they, instead of going into the heart of fiction, you know, and bringing out the world, let's say the way Balzac did or Dickens did, they don't have that weight, you know. They don't have that inner world to them anymore. It's easier, and the market is easier, mm-hmm. if you just go out and report on an event and bring it back.
Mm-hmm.
But what a novelist does is that he gets into the nitty-gritty mm-hmm. Vines of how things happen. Well, about a year or two ago, I saw this come out with John Kenneth Galbraith, you know, who writes books on economics,
right,
and I was surprised to see the guy writing a book on writing a novel. And so you figure, well, here's a guy who, you know, he's supposed to know all the book learning, but yet he wants to write a novel. Now, why is he writing a novel? Because he figures he's missed something, you see. He's really missed the day-to-day, you know, what happens when the crunch gives away, you know, the pressure. And that's why he chose a novel.
The whole, you know, concept of the novel, which is like a 19th century Western idea about 200 years old, is really under attack from, say, the younger writers. What people are concerned with now, they're doing things that you really can't categorize. You know what I mean? I know a woman who's doing a cookbook, but she has, like, autobiographical material in it, and she has, like, telegrams, and she has sides and things like that. And she's doing a lot of things that you would call fiction, so it's like a cross between fiction and nonfiction. So I think that what you're going to have in the 70s are these like monster books. And I think that, you know, America is like the center of like a monster form, stuff that you can't fit into any category. But I'm interested. I mean, I think a novel can be all kinds of things.
But no, I say that these people are withdrawing from the novel for the essential reason that they know where their weakness lies, and that is they just don't know where this they can't get their fingers on the nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they blow it up into a cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you have the advantage of being a sort of day-to-day journalist and you met these people and you know that they're really not monsters but as human as you or I,
well,
then the terror gets in. You see, if you can say a man is a monster, then you put him in a different species and you say, okay, he's in the zoo. But I'm saying the zoo is outside, and that what we really have to know these people who parade around as, you know, nice human John Doe. I'm saying that it's not a zoo, and then we're the public. No, I'm saying if you're going to say America has become a zoo in some respect, that the zoo is on Main Street.
Right, and I think the people who destroy other people, since I believe that life, this is my value. I believe that life is worthy. I'm not in a death trip like this dying religion that we have on our hands, which brought us like this kind of fake, phony kind of humanism, you know, Judeo-Christianity, which is on the way out. You know, there are all kind of religions
out
there.
Yeah, it's always on the way out.
What Timothy Leary calls the God game, which is going on in this country now. And the winner may be a dark horse.
Well,
the thing is that I consider myself and a whole group of black writers, Afro-American writers from coast to coast, not especially the people that you have heard about in the 60s, which has been like a decade of screams and hollering. But I think that what we're trying to do, we are metaphysical detectives, and we are about to make an arrest. And I think what I want to do in my books is to like go in there and drag the guy out, the monster out. I write like books about vampires.
Yeah.
I use a gothic form, and I mix it up with like pulp form, like cartoons. I think the cartoon evolved in this country. You know, Benjamin Franklin invented balloon speech. I can refer you to a book called The History of American Graphics. But I mean, I think that the evolution of this country, you can trace to the evolution of like certain pulp forms. What we do in this country is like we deny popular forms in this country because the whites in this country seem to believe that Europe is more worthy.
I think the fatal flaw. I'm all for cartoons, but I think the fatal flaw in pursuing the cartoon, I don't see technology, but ideology, is that after a while you lose the humanity.
That's the humanist liberal trap, baby. I'm still thinking that you do believe that people are worthy and they're beautiful, the good, true, and beautiful, like that old, Western humanism. I'm saying that maybe it may turn out that the people in this country are pretty one-dimensional, two-dimensional, like really cartoon characters. And the best way to get to them is like the animated cartoon. Walt Disney is like the artist of this culture.
Yeah, but he's flat. He's flat,
right.
And he's
well,
syrupy.
It's a flat
and
culture.
No, I'm saying it's more complex because you have to know, how do these people get this way? How do you go through the usual orthodox, normal American idealist.
You don't think
education.
That's humanism? You don't think that's humanism?
I don't care what you call it. No, see, once you call it, once you give me a label, you make me faceless because you say, okay, this guy's a humanist.
All right,
he's out of my bag.
Right.
You see, once you make me faceless, then I'm like every other.
I'm like
a minority group.
Okay, what is popularly known as liberalism? That's it.
I don't opt for liberalism.
You want to know what made the guy.
Listen,
if a guy's like pointing a bayonet at you, the sane, rational person would try to get that bayonet away from them.
Right.
But the liberals say, well, this guy didn't like his mother, or his father dropped. That's what I'm talking about.
No, well, I would say what a novel does is get this guy in action, and not call him a liberal, but say, what happens when a bayonet is pointed at a guy? See, that's the story. Okay, how do they confront each other in this way? You know, I look at people like Baudelaire, Céline, as humanists, too. Humanist, I just, I throw them into the world and let them pop like popcorn, so to speak, and find out, what their vision of the world is, because we all come at the world from so many different angles, and everybody, is sort of, instead of a torchbearer, if he's a good guy, a real good guy, he's sort of a truth bearer.
I'm in a different position. I'm like an outsider in the culture. Black people are outsiders in this country. They never wanted us here. They brought us over here and kidnapped us from like a beautiful continent, man.
Yeah.
Like, Phyllis Wheatley called Africa, Africa's fancied seat, man. You got animals, you got plants that don't grow anywhere else in the universe. There, we're brought here, we're trapped here, and we're like looking at the thing as outsiders. So I don't see it. I don't want to analyze. I don't want to know what went into make the president of the United States, or somebody like that. I want to describe some of the grotesqueries and the monstrosities that are going on here to show that the West is like threatening the very survival of this planet. That's a grave issue.
But the thing is, I say you can have two different modes of gravity and two different worlds, and they're both the same world. I mean, let's say when the Newtonian mathematics went out of style, it didn't mean that his world was wrong. It just meant that he had his, he saw the world for the time, and he proved it. You know, he verified it scientifically. I'm not saying a novelist should do this, but what a novelist should do is that if somebody comes back and says, well, okay, let's say, how was America at the height of its power? You could read, instead of reading these history books, which really don't tell you the truth,
right,
even though they're nonfiction.
They're
right.
They're fictional.
Right.
History is fiction.
Right, it is.
In the West, they
right.
lie.
So to find the truth, I would say you find more of the truth of America, let's say, in a book like Moby Dick, where you see the beginning of industrial America, then you would...
Or that's like the white Western tradition of literature. I could point to, have you heard of William Wells Brown? You know, 1854, Clotel, the President's Daughter, Frank Webb,
yeah.
The Garys and Their Friends, Sutton
yeah.
Griggs, Imperial, you know, all these
yeah.
novels that blacks have been written and
yeah.
have been like read out of American literature. We can go to our examples, too. I think that what we want to do in this culture is to like avoid, you know, using like Western references. We want to open this place up. You know, we're the only ones who really want to open up. We want to make this a cosmic civilization so that everybody can bring their own thing up to the altar, you know what I mean? But what I see now is like a one-sided, you know, one-dimensional, cornered, cartoon kind of world.
To me, a cartoon, I'm saying, listen, I like the, you know, I admire the freelance Paul Bear, but I say, pursue this, you run out of blood. You know, after all, people are bleeding. And I don't think that, I think what the cartoons get is the grotesqueness, the shock, the punch. But I always want the blood. I want to know how did that blood flow out of them, you know, as in the Greek drama. One other thing, I think when you say Afro-America, you put me up because I would rather say hear you say, I'm an American writer and I'm getting this nightmare down.
Oh, no, see, there you go. Let's put our cards on the table. We're, this is not a uniform culture. I mean, it's like a diverse culture. And if I poll people and they want to call themselves Afro, I'm doing an anthology now, 18 Necromancers from Now, which we published in the fall. And you, if you poll people and this is what they want to call themselves,
yeah.
I think that's okay. There's no squabble about, like, you know, cosmetics or, like, names or, you know, that kind of aesthetic. What I would say is that, you know, it's not a uniform culture. And you do
I'm
have
not
people
saying
who,
it is, because
yeah.
I'm saying I'm using it. I'm using America as a circus tent.
Yeah, well, but there's South America too. This is arrogance, you know. I mean,
right.
Like, you have to include Canada and South America too. That's trivial. But I mean, what I'm saying is that in my work, this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to talk about like these 2% of the you know people of this country like ruining the resources of the world. And I consider that like a tantamount to a sin committed. Say if you go to science fiction to like Dracula.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I try to like drag these things out of the closet. And using like certain forms that I see around me in this country, you do a different thing. But I think that all styles are valid, certainly.
Yeah, right? And I think that the main thing, you know, if I can read the freelance pallbearers and get this sock,
mm-hmm.
you know, really get this sock out of society, I also know there's another way, you know, of picturing it,
right.
And that is, you know, just taking it up by the guts and examining the guts.
Mm-hmm.
And well, you know, whether you call it humanism or what, or liberalism.
Surgery.
Yes, and I don't even call it surgery. I figure, you know, you have to. What I want to know is, you know, like, you know, there are books out now that I value, like The Origin, let's say, of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Which you really find out, you know, they try to show you step by step that, you know, how we thought we came to World War II is a myth. And this is the way it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you show the kids today how it did happen, then there's a way of them trying not to make that same mistake rather than rushing into the bloody pit.
Mm-hmm.
As if they're, you know, a bunch of patriots,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that goes over. So I say the novel has this kind of educational value,
mm-hmm.
plus the entertainment value. You know, I take the entertainment for granted. That you could read this book and know where you are, what I would say, in, you know, the battlefield of human experience. That is, it brings back the world to you that you, as a reader, don't have time to get the insights out of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if the writer doesn't have more insights than the reader, then he shouldn't be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And why the reader comes to a good book is that he wants the insights that he thinks he gets in other books, like in psychology books or sociology books, which just feed him the pap.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not interested in the metaphysical
mm-hmm.
part
mm-hmm.
of the society. I'm interested in the hard, what happened,
mm-hmm.
you know, what happened underneath
mm-hmm.
to drive these people to where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, fundamentally, we all go around thinking we're nice, sober citizens. But yet the daily paper shows us that, you know, we're burning up this world.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Are we burning up this world?
Yeah, what are we doing in Vietnam?
Well, I mean, I'm not in Vietnam. I mean, you know, like, the only black people over there are, like, over there involuntarily.
It's like
Tonto's told the Lone Ranger, you know, what do you mean we?
No, you see, this is where the cop...
You know, it's like you.
No, no, listen, I did a report.
Black people are not making atomic bombs, man. They didn't,
yeah,
you know,
but they're in Vietnam killing as much as the white person.
They would never
think
about, like, putting a nuclear explosion in Aleutian Islands, man.
Oh, I don't know that. If they become part of this Western civilization...
Well, that's hypothetical, right?
No,
hypothetical.
No, look at Vietnam, because there are black soldiers in there killing as readily as the white soldiers.
Yeah, well, they're being used as automatons.
No, they like it too. Yeah, well, I'm sure there are blacks that like it as well as the whites, because I did reporting for a Negro magazine,
mm-hmm.
and they had pictures in there, colored pictures, you mm-hmm. know, up in the real fine graphics mm-hmm. showing, you know, how well the Negro soldier mm-hmm. liked it in Vietnam.
Oh,
and
say,
they were just part of the system.
What do you say about people who are against the war? I mean, the most vocal, the people who really paying dues to correct things like... Vietnam and all these atrocities at this country. And I don't mean we, you know,
yeah,
them
yeah.
over there. You know, people who make the decisions to send the troops in and all this kind of stuff are committing, like the Black Panthers. I mean, it's coming from the black. And these are the ones who really have to pay the heavy dues. They're getting shot every day. And they're the ones who have the guts to get up and talk about it. All these guys in Chicago, A.B. Hoffman, talking about revolution for the hell of it.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
nobody put a gag on his lips. Incidentally, man, none of these writers or organizations are coming out for Cleaver, you know, like PEN. They're always talking about, like, the Soviet Union and this kind of business, you know.
Once you get Cleaver into the commodity market, you know, that's what I'm saying about the soldiers.
Yeah, see, well, the only thing
no matter who you bring into the commodity yeah. market, they're molded into the same way. And
I think Cleaver's probably one of the best writers in America. I'm just saying that if his reading list had been, if he'd read his own people, like Richard Wright, who went through that stuff, God
yeah.
would fail. If he read Chester Himes, The Lonely Crusade, if he'd read Paul Robeson, if he'd read Claude McKay, right? People like that, he wouldn't have gone to. He'd be still be here, because we need him in the struggle. But I think that when you get wound up with these liberals, you know, who have all kind of perverse designs upon black people, who want to use black people as cannon fodder. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Well, they would use white people as cannon fodder.
I don't know. No, it's always
sure.
us. If Hayden and those guys think revolution's so groovy, why don't they go out there and face the troops? Why don't they go out there, you know, and face the police? Like these blacks have the guts to do, you know what I mean? This kind of thing.
Yeah, well,
but that's what I see in the Cleaver thing, you know.
Yeah, well, I would look at it this way. I have a line in my book that says that, you know, what is the system? And it says the system is easily recognized. Everybody cries out in anguish in his turn, and no one listens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the deafness we have toward each other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not discounting the malice,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's not only malice.
We don't have any malice. We don't. What do you mean? We don't have any malice towards anybody. We're like the most. Well, the black people have compassion to a fault. They like sympathize.
You should come to our school board meetings.
They sympathize. I'm not talking about. I'm not talking about Manhattan. I'm not talking about. There you go again with Manhattan.
You know what happens at our school?
No, I don't know
meetings.
What happens.
You know,
I don't. Man, anybody who goes to school nowadays, man, with television is crazy anyway. I mean, you know, they ought to close up all the dead institutions in this country. At the universities, have people move in those buildings and put them to good use. But getting back to the thing, the problem, I think the black people are the most compassionate people in this country. I mean, who else would, like,
I agree with you.
Take
who,
all this nonsense?
Who would
We're
sit
not,
still for so
right,
many years?
Right,
yeah.
400 years.
Yeah, well, you know, Erskine Cordwell told me a fine thing. He said that, you know, who do you think built the mansions in the South? You know, it was built with black labor.
Yeah, right.
But
right.
he himself, I think what makes
Who you
his...
think built the psychology of America, man?
Oh,
black
was...
white people
no,
talk
was
like
he
we
a,
talk?
No, was he a
Excuse
long...
me. Black, oh, black, you know, white... Dean Rusk said, advised the North Vietnamese to cool it. And Richard Nixon says, sock it to me. I mean, sometimes I wonder who's integrating whom. I think probably some strange, mysterious processes are occurring in this country
no,
that we
I...
haven't even gotten to.
No,
but,
I think
you
what
know what I mean?
What's very hard to realize is that that this also happens to whites, because the majority of the population in colonial America were indentured servants,
mm-hmm.
which were white.
Mm-hmm.
So the white psychology came here before the black, and that is that, you know, if you're the man in power and you have the muscle, then you take the, you know, the underling. You know, these servants were originally white. You know, and when you had to farm, when there was a product to be farmed, like
well,
cotton,
I don't know.
Then you got
yeah.
the cheaper labor.
Okay.
And
I don't know. What would Rolling Stone say about that? What would Moby Grape say about that? What would Janis Joplin say about that? When I hear Janis Joplin singing, it sounds like Bessie Smith to me, baby. That's
yeah.
like, you know, the younger generation of people are going black, man. And
yeah, well, the music...
That might save this country. You know, people picking up our modes of behavior, our talk.
Yeah, but they'll just sell it back to you.
As Timothy Leary says, man, like, we are freer... We are groovier people, man. We are hedonists, and we are like lovers, man. We're not haters.
Yeah,
you know,
but you
these
see,
people over here are haters.
Yeah, musically, we're black orientated. But what we do, we take black music and we give it back to you as white. Like, let's say what Paul Whiteman did to the jazz is what we do with everything else.
Well, I mean, it's not just music. Like, the whole lifestyle, man, of like so-called counterculture is not only influenced, although these racist scholars say they're influenced by American Indian and Zen, but they're influenced by black men. There are more people doing the boogaloo at Woodstock than singing Hare Krishna. That's what I'm seeing. It's not just like the song. It's like the whole lifestyle, man. The younger generation of whites, as far as I'm reading them, and they have a long way to go. They're trying to get out of this stuff, man. They're trying to get rid of white man. Like somebody, you know, sitting. No, I'm not talking about you, Morris. You're a lovable guy. You're a nice guy. But I mean, like, some guy sitting talking about, like, Greece, Newtonian mathematics.
What are you talking about, me? Come close.
All these Western examples, man. Why don't we try to talk about the planet, man, instead of
I am. This is how we live.
Some guy with a toga and, like, laurels or something, man,
well,
making a speech
in Athens.
He's not
in this world either.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you think a guy on peyote is in this world?
Well, when I hear William Buckley, I think that, and Eugene McCarthy talking, this is a great thing. Johnson said Eugene McCarthy talks to God in Latin, man. That's the whole thing. You got Augustine poets in this country.
I'm not for that.
Receiving,
all you gotta do is read my book, because I read your book and you would say,
receiving the Pulitzer Prize, you know, for writing like somebody wrote in the 4th century in the West. That's a scandal. I think we want to, like, get away from that.
Okay.
Because, you know, they use that. Don't whites use that?
Yeah, but I want to
culture.
Say,
a little, okay, as Leroy Jones says, a little Mozart over the Emerson, or something like that.
Who said?
Jones.
Yeah,
Taylor,
well, I knew,
like,
Leroy Jones when he was writing flowery poetry, and I was in Washington marching for, you know, I wouldn't say black liberation. But,
oh, I don't know about that, man. Jones has always been...
Yeah, he's a good guy now, but you that's what I'm saying, that you come to your knowledge in your own way. You know, I wouldn't accuse, say, Jones as an Augustan poet just because he wrote flowery poetry at one time.
Well, he wasn't an Augustan poet. He was, like, coming out of Yeats. I'm talking about people who were classicists, like Robert Lowell, man, those guys, making translations from Horace and stuff. Who needs that stuff? I'm talking about, like, opening up the culture. And what we get in Western education, and this is what the Black Studies thing is all about, is somebody saying, like, American literature begins with James Fenimore Cooper, right? Or before that, Brockton or somebody,
yeah,
man. And comes up to now, to Mailer. When there's a whole tradition of, like, Indians writing this country, Puerto Rican people writing this country, Victor Hernandez Cruz, Perry Thomas, tradition of, like, black people writing this country, and you know,
yeah, but
why is the American public all of a sudden thrilled about Jean Toumer, man? Jean Toumer wrote Cain in 1923.
To me, I look at it that the real terror is that one day here is Ishmael Reed, and he's giving me this real rebel talk, but soon as that talk becomes popular, you go into the commodity machine, and you're going to come out with all the prizes.
What's wrong with that? I mean, what's wrong with you guys? You're novelists. The novelist, that's why I don't consider myself a novelist. A novelist believes that he is like the aristocracy, man. This is a royal profession, and you guys think you're better than everybody else.
Well, you're a novelist.
Well, I'm not a novelist.
You write.
Well, I'm a writer.
You
yeah.
use words.
Well,
you have a story.
That doesn't make me a novelist. I don't have a story. Most of the times I don't, man. I'm
well,
improvised.
What do you want to call yourself?
I'm a writer. You know, Black's been writing about as
I know,
long
but
as
not every
else.
Black yeah. is interested to me. There are a lot of Black writers that bore me stiff, and, you know, and I don't care. A Black writer or a white writer, you have to come through to me. I don't care what you are. And, I mean, I would pick up some Black writing. I say, well, you know, it's, you know, I like the raving, but I just don't see it.
Oh, see, raving, propaganda, right?
Yeah.
See, there again, you know.
I'm
like,
not saying propaganda. Yeah. I'm saying that all writers, white and Black or whatever you... There's a point.
No, you know, you read, no, the tendency is to, like, take one Black person in this country and, like, interpret this experience as belonging to, like, millions of people. I see this in New York Times, for example, somebody saying, this book really tells us about the Black experience. One guy. This guy might be a lunatic. You know what I mean?
Right.
There are 30 million people, and we've seen excesses in the last 10 years where any nut off the street, no matter how... The only criterion was, like, whether the guy was grotesque enough can get on the air and say, well, we want this, we want that, we don't like this, you know, and giving all the list. We're like 30, you know, I mean, there are 30 million Black people. There are probably 40 million Black people in this country, because you always underestimate the number of barbarians within your gates. You know, you can go back to Rome and talk about that. But I'm saying, what we want to do now, what I see around the country is that, like, people are getting away from this abolitionist tearjerker kind of, like, novel or writing that, like, his appeal is directed to somebody's conscience, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because we found that's only been entertainment. It's never moved any of these people to, like, eradicate these issues, these novels so meticulously enumerate.
Well,
I'm thinking that, like, people ought to look out for, like, the artists.
Yeah.
Black artists have always been discouraged because of the kind of thesis, which I suspect this is just a hunch. You know, we play hunches, man. We're not, like, scientists.
You're a metaphor.
So, I got a hunch that the native who goes the way of art is looked upon as being uppity. You know, he loses his seat in Congress, or he's thrown as heavyweight champion of the world.
Yeah, right.
And, like, what I see now is, like, a lot of artists are getting through. That, you know, there's a big struggle because, you know, a guy who writes an abolitionist sadomasochistic thing, thriller, right?
yeah.
For the directed old ladies in the suburbs, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to kill you, you know, tomorrow at 6 o'clock. Watch out. You know, leave the door open. I'm going to come in the window. You know, everybody likes that. That's a thriller. But, like, all these artists have a difficult time. Jean Toumer wrote Cain, 1923, sold 600 copies. People like that. Claude McKay have a difficult time. Claude McKay had a difficult time because he didn't cater to the same kind of forces that are surrounded some of the Black writers today. You know what forces. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
I think writers, if they're original, they always have a hard time.
If you look like Al Young,
well,
for example, California, Al Young has written a book called Dancing. It's a book of poems, beautiful poems. No hollering or screaming in there. He's an artist who writes probably better than all these other guys who are around here getting Pulitzer Prizes and stuff.
But Norman I'm saying Pritchard, that this has always poems. Happened to people. Like, if you don't mind me saying, yeah. Classical authors, this happened to Stendhal.
I think
if you get a writer that's really going to bring up, you know.
No, I'm just saying, well, Morris, you said raving. You know, you said you don't want to hear these guys rave. You only read one book. I'm saying when I read your white literature, I don't say these guys are raving. I say, wow, there's a diversity.
Yeah, but see, you're saying that everything I say is a great big bromo sells, you know, it's raving. I'm not saying that. I said one little incident.
Yeah.
I would say, well, if this guy turns me off, it's not because he's black. It's because I want to get the experience.
Oh, I see.
You
okay.
see?
Okay.
You know, yeah. I don't figure that all black writers are like bromo sells and they just come up and give you the fizz.
I'm just saying there's a tendency. See, when I go to white American culture, say, gee, there's a lot of stuff going on. I would never compare like Ted Williams to like Leonard Bernstein. You know, these are two different individuals.
Yeah.
But like somebody will come to the black culture and say, "Wow, you know, this is like a vehicle through which one person's experience is a vehicle through which I can interpret the collective experience."
Yeah, like when I read your book, didn't I tell you that I thought you were, pardon me for saying this, that you remind me of Lenny Bruce? Did you resent that? You did. Now I see you did. It got you up in arms, right? Now, what should I have did, given you a black contrast? You know, say, okay, do I know a black Lenny Bruce and then say it to you? No. You know, if you want me to be frank with you, this is how I work out of my culture, and you have to know, well, okay, this guy may be bats, but this I understand it better as long as he doesn't con me by saying I'm the black Lenny Bruce.
I'm not talking about you. I'm saying they.
Talk about
the
me.
The dark forces of the universe. I italicize they. When they do this, you know, they say like, you know, they deny that there are like millions of people in here, all kinds of molds, all kinds of styles, all kinds of opinions.
Right.
You know what I mean? But it's led us to like a dictatorship, just a serial dictatorship, one after the other. I'm waiting for the next one to come along saying he's you know, it's been revealed to him from some vision, and he's gonna like lead people. I think black people should deserve a referendum, and they should go out and see what really black people really think. That's all I'm saying.
You have been listening to Analog, a radio series we present in cooperation with the National Conference of Christians and Jews. Our guests today were two novelists, Morris Rennick, author of Siam, Miami, and Ishmael Reed, author of Freelance Pallbearers and Yellowback Radio Broke Down. On each of these analog broadcasts, we have asked the participants to share something with us that has guided them and might be considered food for thought. Today, Ishmael Reed stated the axiom that has guided him all his life. The demons of the old religion are the gods of the new. And when state magicians fail, unofficial magicians become stronger. And Morris Rennick told us, even though it probably never existed, I think we have to get back to the American ideal of having every man do what he wants. Fred Facey speaking. This recorded program, produced by Rhoda Grady and directed by Jeffrey Culliver, has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
This is the NBC Radio Network.